It's the kicky music that means it's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm your thankfully temporary host, Stephen Thompson. This week, inspired by a trailer for a 2014 reboot of RoboCop, we talk about rebooted movie franchises we'd actually like to see. Then we talk about a pop cultural phenomenon we've only barely mentioned up until now, Duck Dynasty. And as always, we will talk about what's making us happy this week. Now, Linda Holmes is at the Toronto International Film Festival, so we've got a slightly reconstituted panel this week. Let's go around the table. Glenn Weldon. What do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And Trey Graham, how about you?
I cover movies and theater and that sort of thing.
And finally, back by popular demand, Tanya Ballard Brown. Ooh. Tell the nice people what you do at NPR.
I'm an editor that works with the National Desk, and I'm also a step cousin to the Code Switch blog.
Nice. Now, before we dive into our first topic this week, I do want to make a correction I had meant to mention last week, namely that in our VMAs discussion, I mentioned offhand that Bruno Mars was the, quote-unquote, the only African-American to win a major award. Now, as many have pointed out, Bruno Mars, not African-American, is of Filipino, Jewish, and Spanish descent. I was trying to work my... It was going to be like the only minority to him, but then Selena Gomez, and
You could say brown.
I could have just said brown. Anyway, now that he's performing on the Super Bowl halftime show, which was just announced, he's still in the headlines, which is still compelling people to write in and point out my error. Thanks a lot, Bruno Mars. Anyway, our first topic today, rebooted movie franchises we would like to see, was inspired by the new RoboCop trailer, and before we dive in, Glenn Weldon, what do you want to see from a rebooted RoboCop?
I don't want to see a rebooted RoboCop. The trailer looks pretty bad. The costume has been around for a while. We've seen it online. This is the first time we actually see it in action. It looks dumb. The motivation for the character has been changed according to the trailer. A lot of the things that the first movie got absolutely right. It was a satire of the sort of Reagan-era action film, while still being a really great Reagan-era action film.
Yeah.
But it got me thinking of, you know, when a reboot like this is announced, there are a range of reactions. They tend to fall into two categories. There is the, how dare you touch that?
Right.
It was perfect. You're destroying my childhood.
Yes.
To also the...
People's childhoods are constantly in peril.
Constantly under attack. To the other side of the spectrum, which is, why that? Sort of apathy. Mm-hmm. So in the middle is a sliver where you can come up with the perfect reboot. If you meet a set of criteria that I have worked out methodically, as is my want. You ready to hear them?
Yes.
I will lay these criteria out, and then we'll go around and I'll lay out our ideas for perfect reboots, and we'll see very, very wrong you are. Number one, there has to be a sense that there is some untapped narrative potential still in it. It still has to feel like you haven't turned every corner, you haven't explored every character.
So not the remake of Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho shot by shot.
For example, that doesn't meet it. The second thing, there has to be a sense that when it came out, it was not acclaimed by the culture at large. It met the culture in a weird way so that the reception of it wasn't quite, maybe it was a little bit before its time, or maybe it was just sort of out of joint. Mm. Part three, it can't be generic. There has to be something idiosyncratic. There has to be something that it has a specific pull about it. But this is 3B. It can't be too idiosyncratic, because that's when you get, it becomes beloved. And that's when people say, well, because of this performance or because of this approach or because of the fact that it was a satire of a Reagan-era action film.
just shut mine down.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. And then finally, and this is the toughest one, it has to feel remotely necessary, which is a nice way of saying enough time has passed, which is why you got this backlash against Amazing Spider-Man, because only 6 years had passed between the last Spider-Man film and the new one. So that's my set of criteria. Go.
Wow. All right. Well, Trey Graham has already said that his has been shot down, but let's hear it.
Well, are you ready for this? Are you ready for the
proposal? Y'all ready for this?
I don't think you're ready for this.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
Obviously, All About Eve is the film I've picked.
Do you want to tell the people, the children out there, what All About Eve is about?
Children, oh my children.
Gather around Uncle Trey's knee.
All About Eve.
Not too close.
Well, because there will be hand gestures. All About Eve is the story of Margot Channing, the great star, who takes under her wing a character played by, is it Anne Baxter?
Yes.
Anne Baxter plays Eve Harrington, who is a fan who's come from the heartland to bask in the glow of a stardom. I don't know. Anyway, she's sort of stalked by this fan. She takes her under her wing, introduces her to Cafe Society, And then bad things happen.
So what year is this again?
1950, a black and white film. The first screen performance of Marilyn Monroe as an ingenue being introduced to Cafe Society at the same time. It is this fantastic tale of sort of a star on the rise, a star on the decline, and what you get when you do someone a good turn.
Come on, get up. I'll buy you a drink.
I'll admit I may have seen better days, but I'm still not to be had for the price of a cocktail, like a salted peanut.
So it fails Glenn's test in that it was welcomed. It met with much appreciation at the time. I think that you might argue for the necessity of it, because there's a whole bunch of people who haven't seen it, oddly enough. Mm-hmm. And I would like to think that a major reboot would drive people back to the original, if nothing else. Mm-hmm. But I also think that it is by its nature both fit for our time and out of date. By out of date, I mean that a lot of the performances are in a kind of acting style that you don't get anymore and that we don't welcome anymore.
Well, just that very mannered way of speaking is very different.
See, I think you could get Betty Davis. I think you could get away with Betty Davis in this day and age. She's playing a Broadway actress.
Who is your Betty Davis?
I did some of this, and I think... I'm not sure I've got anybody quite as idiosyncratic as Betty Davis, although it has just popped into my head.
But Tilda Swinton.
I was just going to say Tilda Swinton or Sandra Bernhard.
Sure. Mm.
Sandra Bernhard would be excellent.
Okay. Now, my criteria is not whether or not you can make a good one. My criteria is whether or not you're going to get a backlash. And you would get a backlash.
Oh, such a backlash.
Because, again, this goes to my earlier point about the performances. That film is made by a performance, defined by its performances.
There are two absolutely indelible performances in that film. And it would take somebody with the eccentricity and idiosyncrasy of a Tilda Swinton or a Sandra Bernhard to do justice to the role of Margot Channing. Alternatively, you have to have someone who's completely bland on the surface and a complete viper underneath to play Eve Harrington. My nominee was going to be Scarlett Johansson.
Sure.
Or I was thinking either...
I just feel the backlash mounting.
Right? Yeah, I was gonna say Sharon Stone and Scarlett Johansson, maybe.
Wow. Or
Gwyneth Paltrow and Scarlett Johansson. But when you asked me the question, those other names popped into my head at the same time. In the role of Addison DeWitt... Tell me how you feel.
All right.
Stephen Fry.
Sure, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I still feel like no one was clamoring.
Yeah, that's my point.
Well, no one's clamoring, duh. It's a surprise.
Okay. But they've already made this movie with Gwyneth Paltrow. It's called Country Strong. So I don't think
that means,
Oh,
no.
Okay, well, I've been shot down. All right, fine. Just go rent.
You know
all
what?
About Eve.
Yeah, it was a game effort. I will do far, far worse. I'll tell you that right now. So, Tanya Ballard Brown, hit me.
Lady sings the blue. Sings the blue. I will have this in every when the technology changes, I get whatever updated version of the technology is. I had it on VHS.
So you have VHS Laserdisc.
I have every version because I want to make sure that I can always see this movie. Now I will say there was the reboot of Sparkle, which is sort of, and it didn't, you know, I liked it. I liked Mike Epps, but it didn't quite come off. And again, Barry Gordy's still with us. Mm-hmm. He was the one who put this first one together. Maybe, I mean, of course we can't pull Diana back out.
I was going to say, again, for the infants.
Yeah, sorry, for the children. For the this was a movie. Diana Ross was the star. She couldn't do this role now. And it needs someone who can, it needs someone who, like Diana, can be a lady, because all through this movie, she was a lady.
Can be a lady and sing the blues.
We still haven't explained what the movie is about. Diana Ross plays Billie Holiday.
Yes,
it's a biography of Billie Holiday.
She plays Billie Holiday, but she... early on just knew her voice was not Billie Holiday's voice. So she sings all the songs in her, you know, her way.
Someday you'll come along.
Yes, sir.
The man I love. And he'll be big and strong. The man I love. And when he comes my way.
They're interpreted for her soprano-y, softy, you know, voice. She didn't have the grit and the heroine of Billie's voice, but she did play cracked out lady in the padded room. Like, she was on point with that. But even then, she was a lady. Even though she was wrapped up in a straight jacket, bouncing from room with her eye, you know, she was still a lady. So it needs someone who can sing and who can still be a lady and be...
And gibber.
Yeah. Who can do it? And then I don't know. Like, all the people I think who have the gravitas to play, you know, Louis McKay, you know, you want my arm to fall off. Ooh, did I tell y'all I met Billy Dee Williams?
Yes, Billy Dee Williams is also in this movie.
Yes, he was Louis McKay, you know. And if you don't know anything else about that movie, remember the part when he says, you want my arm to fall off? All the women swooned. And my mother loved this movie. And mm-hmm. this was something, I don't know why, because it was a bit too grown for me as a child. Mm-hmm. that we would watch on Sunday when the men folks would watch football. Mm-hmm. We would watch Lady Sings the Blues. But if awesome. I could see a reboot of that done right.
But throw out a name, Tanya. Throw out a name. Somebody.
Oh, gosh. You know who could play Louis McKay?
Okay.
Y'all know who I think can, could I play can answer Louis
McKay. Let me see. Does it
start with an I?
Does it
yes.
start with I?
Don't you,
and
can't
Andrews,
you see?
Idris
can't
Elba?
You see Idrissa Akuna Elba?
Oh, my God.
Playing Louis McKay. The problem is the women that I think could do the singing, I'm not sure they could do that, you know, so that's where it got. And I really did spend some time thinking about.
I would like to nominate the ghost of Amy Winehouse to
her voice
to do the voice.
Yes.
I'm not sure who the actress needs to
All right,
be.
Done. Cut print.
Right? Yeah.
Yes.
Well, see, this is the balance that's trickiest to strike and where I got incredibly hung up trying to come up with something because, you know, Glenn has there has to be this rule number two was not acclaimed by the public at large. But there's also this, it has to be made.
Right.
Like, there has to be, mm-hmm. there. I mean, you said untapped narrative potential, but really we're talking about a way to tap massive commercial potential.
Sure.
Or they probably wouldn't bother. So I was really looking at blockbusters mm-hmm. that could stand to be rebooted. So I was just automatically...
The Ten Commandments.
There you go. So I just was...
Sound of Music.
So I was automatically thrown off. I mean, I didn't think about unsuccessful things.
Sure.
So I was looking at how do you remake or reboot a massively successful franchise? And I think the rule that I came up with was it can't have an iconic performance
okay.
at
so
the center.
Yeah, that kind of is related. Okay.
So I feel like that's almost the most important thing because I was just sort of going over, like, what are the most successful franchises?
Right.
And so, like, a Die Hard or a Back to the Future, I mean, I was thinking also more in the vintage that would likely actually be remade.
Sure.
The way like, a RoboCop was. I was mm-hmm. thinking in RoboCop vintage. And weirdly enough, what I kept coming... I mean, I thought a little bit about, like, Roger Rabbit mm-hmm. and being surprised that Who Framed Roger Rabbit has never been rebooted, sequelized, remade
Talk
in
about
any way.
Talk about ready for a sequel.
Yeah. Man.
You've got the wrong idea about me, Mr. Valiant. I'm a pawn in this, just like Roger. Can you help me find him? Just name your price, and I'll pay it.
Yeah, I bet you would. You gotta have the rabbit to make the scam work.
No, 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 I love my husband. You've got me all wrong. You don't know how hard it is being a woman looking the way I do.
Yeah, well. You don't know how hard it is being a man, looking at a woman looking the way you do.
I'm not bad. I'm just drawn that way.
My fear with it is I'm actually afraid of what they would, that they would wind up doing computer animation instead of that hand-drawn quality.
Yeah, it's right. such an amazing film, and they created such a rich universe there. And I would love to spend more time in that universe. And you're right. I'm terrified of what would come out.
Yeah. It was a very, very successful movie, but it was right. never franchised in any significant... I mean, they've made more Baby Herman cartoons, mm-hmm. at least one or two more.
Yeah, they did.
But I'm kind of surprised.
Man, I would watch a Jessica Rabbit movie.
Me too. Man.
All right. Well, what's yours, Glenn?
All right. Mine fits all my criteria. Go figure. but I had to kind of go through because, you know, one of the things that occurred to me is that everything I thought of has already been rebooted. It's just so much has been rebooted.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have talked on the show about the 1985 magnum opus Gymkata, which is about Kurt Thomas in tight white shorts being a spy who combines gymnastic skills with karate kills. That film.
Just going back to the classics.
Just going
this
back
is like
to
episode one or two.
I do think we go and we get Kurt Thomas to be the wizened sensei. I don't know how wizened he is, but he could be the sensei, and we get somebody new to combine not, you know, men's gymnastics. It's kind of old. We combine rhythmic gymnastics with hoop and ball
the ribbon.
And ribbon.
And ribbons.
With, like, MMA. Like, because you can't just do karate. So that's one idea. What I decided upon was a Japanese anime television series from the mid-70s that was syndicated on American television in the early 80s that got many, many, many things right, chief of which is a kick-ass theme song.
I know this.
Yes, you do.
I hear laser guns.
I do.
Let the record show that Glenn Weldon is singing silently along.
Lip syncing.
It's Star Blazer.
Star Blazer, absolutely. Okay. This is epic space opera. This is huge. This has a love story. The plot. Now listen to the Americanized syndicated version. Listen to the names that they pulled out of their butts to kind of make this as grandiose. So the planet Earth is under attack by the planet Gamelon, whose leader, Deslok, is throwing planet bombs at Earth, which is poisoning the planet. So they must convene the Star Force, a military expedition, to recommission a old Japanese battleship, outfit it for space travel, and it goes on a quest to the distant planet Iskandar, where Queen Starsha is keeper of the cosmic DNA, which can restore planet. But they...
Do you do all this in a crawl in the first
few... No. They explain it every time. So Queen Starsha is keeper of the cosmic DNA, which can restore Earth, but they must reach Iskandar and get back with the cosmic DNA within 1 year, because as it says at the end of each and every episode, hurry, Star Force, there are only 237 days left. This has stakes, it's huge. The hot-headed young ensign is named Derek Wildstar because it was the era of Luke Skywalker when you can just take a name and a space thing. So it's like Rex Blast Radius. You know, it's of this time. His girlfriend is named Nova. Just one name, Nova, like Cher, because it's all you need. And she, of course, is destined to be with Wildstar because, of course, Wildstar, Nova, they belong together. There is the crusty old Captain Avatar. We'd have to change that name because Cameron would sue. There is, of course, the reason for this reboot is the villain of the piece, Leader Deslok, who talks like this. He's got a cape, of course, that swishes around like he does. He's got blue skin and sort of blondish hair. So imagine like a really sinister fey smurfette, basically.
A man who fights for his homeland fights on, even when there is no hope. Isn't that what you're doing now? Your Earth has surrendered to the Comet Empire, yet the Star Force goes on fighting.
And he always deals with everybody with a, not a sneer, but with a smirk. He's very amused by himself. This guy was a style icon to 11-year-old Glenn in a big way, because he also always carries a goblet. And the goblet
he's
little...
like Bishop Don Juan walking around
totally is.
With a pimp cup.
And so he would come on screen. There was something very effete, fey, about this character. So when he would come on screen, on the big view screen, he would stare down at Derek Watson and he'd say, "Go ahead, Wildstar. Fire the wave motion gun. Fire the gun, Wildstar." Like that. It was just so, I just wanted to be everything about this guy. So.
You don't say.
So. Now, there has been a live action reboot of this in Japan. However, it doesn't have any of these crazy names and ridiculousness that the American syndicated version has. So this is what we need. I don't know who you get to play. I don't know who you get to play Derek and Watson. You just go to a big vat where they keep, where they grow like CW stars and you just pull them out and you hose off the nutrient slime, you shove them in front of a camera. It doesn't matter. The kids, it doesn't matter. For Captain Avatar, you want a Tommy Lee Jones. Old, crusty.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
For Deslok, I don't know. If you could go young, you could go Ben Whishaw. He'd need to fade up a little bit. But a little bit. He would need to up it. Or Michael Emerson, the guy who played Ben Linus on Lost, has some of that same affect.
No, just... you know who needs to do that?
Yeah, tell me.
From Galaxy Quest. The guy who was, we are following you all the...
Gino Corleone from Veronica Mars, that guy.
He does that voice, but it's a different voice. This is up here. This is very...
I think it's clear that Glenn is going to have to play this part.
I was
going to
say, I feel like Glenn not only should play this part, but should speak in that voice for the remainder of the
show. It hurts. But anyway, so that's Star Blazers. I want a live-action reboot, and I want it now.
All right, we went in four very different directions with this. But if you, gentle listener, have something that you would like to see rebooted, we will do our best to make it happen. Go to our Facebook page at facebook.com/PCHH. All right, our next topic.
I can't get away from the impression that one of those things was not like the other. And all I have to say is cheese has no business being on a turkey sandwich.
Cheese does have no business being on a turkey sandwich. Trey, for those of you who assumed that he was just saying that, is quoting a line from Duck Dynasty. I think it's fair to say, gigantic pop cultural phenomenon.
Right? Yes.
The season 4 premiere back in August was the highest. It was at least the highest rated show in the history of A&E.
It is, if I remember the statistic correctly, it's the highest rated non-scripted cable premiere in history.
Wow.
That's tap dancing around some successful enterprises. Wow. I believe it was at least at the end of season 3, it was like second only to The Walking Dead as far as cable programming. It is a gigantic.
It's big. Was it better than The Wire?
I didn't say it was better. I didn't say Duck Dynasty was superior to The Wire.
No, the numbers. I'm saying.
Yeah, I'm sure. Oh. I'm sure of it.
Yeah, The Wire is probably.
Especially given in its time. Yeah. The Wire is one of these things that has built and grown and built and grown. This seems to me more like a phenomenon in the vein, at least in terms of how deep it's going to take hold for long periods of time, more in the vein of an Osbournes or a John and Kate plus 8.
Yeah.
John and Kate plus 8 was a record-setting.
Right.
Show in its time. But quick synopsis of the show. It's very easy to synopsize.
It is very
easy. It's a multi-generational family in West Monroe, Louisiana.
Monroe.
Jeez Louise. Rhymes
with fun.
Okay, we have a couple of Southerners here.
West Monroe, Louisiana. Come on now. I'm from North Carolina.
You're from North Carolina.
I ever.
And now Trey is from South Carolina.
South Carolina represent.
Okay, so you guys are going to fight at some point, right? Uh-huh. Like there's got to be some sort of rivalry.
No, because North Carolina won. Hey.
Now, they are set in West Monroe, Louisiana.
Monroe.
That's what he said.
That's exactly what I said. No, you said Monroe.
There's way too much O in there. There's too much on.
Stop it.
West Monroe, Louisiana.
Okay, Monroe. They're based in this place in Louisiana. They are a multi-generational family, the Robertsons.
Yes.
The family empire, and it is an empire, is built around duck calls. They perfected the duck call and have made millions of damn dollars. And the sort of patriarch of the family is Phil Robertson. You have his brother, Cy, who is affectionately known as Uncle Cy, who is a lovable eccentric. Phil and his wife, Miss Kay, have 4 sons, each with their own wives and children. Son, Willie, is the businessman, the CEO of Duck Commander, this company that Phil started, which now Willie, being a very, very shrewd businessman, has turned into a gigantic empire. And then the 3 main sons who work in the duck calling business, this is actually more convoluted than I thought it was.
Right.
They all have gigantic ZZ Top beards, and the ZZ Top song Sharp Dressed Man serves as the theme song for the show. So, Duck Dynasty, just for those who have not seen it.
Well, I had an opportunity to watch a few episodes of that show, and I have to say that I loved it. I love Duck Dynasty. Uncle Cy, Phil, Willie, Jay. These are my people, okay?
Oh, my God.
I'm from the... You know I like to mash, and these are people who mash the gas. You know, I love the way the family interacted with each other. I love Uncle Cy. He is crazy. I would love to hang out with Uncle Cy. Uncle Cy's carrying around that pitcher of tea in that plastic cup all the time.
Right.
I mean, I'm assuming that's tea, but...
They say it's sweet tea.
Sweet tea. I knew it was sweet tea. You know why?
Of course it's sweet tea.
Because
he's in Louisiana.
He is from the South. He knows how tea should be made.
Right.
Okay, but the family dynamic is an interesting facet of
this
show.
I love how they interact. But you know what? Uncle Cy really... Well, I loved Uncle Cy, but I also love Grandpa Phil, because Grandpa Phil is determined to get the kids out of the house and... into the teach him how to live from the land. He taught him how to make some kind of jelly that I had never heard of.
Uh-huh.
And he took him fishing and caught a catfish. and one of them I had to watch twice because the wife's reaction to this was so different from how I think I would have reacted when I came, if I came in the house and there was a dead beaver in my seat.
Now, I've lived with Jace, so I'm used to the awful smells that he brings to the table.
Why is that in my sink?
Well, I was gonna wash blood off of him.
That's a good idea.
But Corey ain't gonna be so understanding.
Hey. Oh. Wait, what is that smell?
It's a beaver.
Jace, why is there a beaver in my sink?
I killed the beaver.
That beaver smells bad.
That's what a rodent smells like.
Okay, I mean, but why is, oh my, how did the crawfish get in the house?
Look, I got some crawfish in the tub. I'm purging them. Don't panic.
What tub? Fuck. Where's the tub?
I wouldn't have been focused on the live crawfish in the tub because right. I know I'm going to eat those later on. Right. What is this other dead animal?
What am I going to do with this beaver?
Right.
I
would have died.
Right. So it was entertaining. And part of what I liked about it and part of what I think the appeal to the show is that these people are filthy rich. But they're just like your name, you know, they're very down home.
Right. They're not
folksy. Yeah. People, but and they grandpa keeps talking about making people rednecks and
money hasn't changed them. You get a sense that they yes. would be that yeah. they would act the way they act if there weren't money.
Yes.
I can't tell for sure how filthy rich they are, but you know, but they live in a relatively unostentatious way. And it's, you know, this show and shows like it, especially reality TV shows of a certain kind, trade on a couple of received truisms about Southern life. Family is family, no matter how far they make you completely insane. And number two, we in the South don't put our crazy relatives down at the funny farm. We put them in a rocking chair on the front
sure
porch
do.
Where they can entertain the neighbors and scare off the traveling salesman.
Yep.
So I said received truisms. To what extent these truisms are actually true anymore, I can't actually say. But I expect that the distance between that image of the South and the reality of the South as it's lived now is roughly the same as the profit potential of these shows.
Well, this brings me to my main takeaway, which is that this is just as contrived as any other reality show
sure.
out there.
Oh, very it, much so. It,
you can feel the presence of the reality producer mm-hmm. Goosing the storylines and manipulating things so everything kind of ties up in the end of each episode. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all reality shows feed their subjects lines. You get the sense some of these lines were fed to them.
Very much so.
Very, very much so. But there is a sweetness. It's a very well-calculated, mm-hmm. thoroughly calculated sweetness.
It's not messy. That's
right.
what yeah. I liked about it. It yeah. wasn't messy. There's no hair pulling and
well, see, this
throwing
is the thing,
and backhanding. And
I understand the appeal of the show because every episode ends with them, every episode yeah. I saw ends with them gathered around the table, yep. having dinner with friends and family, and saying grace.
Father, we're so thankful for all the many blessings you give us. Thank you for these crawfish and for Jace cooking them all up. Pray all this through Jesus. Amen.
Amen.
Dig in.
All right, let's get on.
Right? Jesus is name-checked in this show far more than he is on any other
very,
show that's
very,
not.
Very, very religious family, and yep. they don't hide that.
Absolutely. So this is a show that you can sit your kids down mm-hmm. with you. This is in the tradition of Father Knows Best, Brady Bunch, It Is Enough, Seventh Heaven. But even Seventh Heaven got a little sexy time toward the end there. So this is, like, that seems to me like this kind of family drama has been chased off of the networks mm-hmm. into reality TV.
Unlike Father Knows Best, you will learn how to skin a frog.
There is also mm-hmm. that.
And there are beavers in the sink.
But there is also to the show. I mean, this show does not condescend in the way
really
that
doesn't.
I think that
right.
Honey Boo Boo
it
does.
Really doesn't.
In a way that Real Housewives condescends. I mean,
yes,
I think there's
right.
an aggressiveness to the way those shows are
you
presented.
You are meant to like these people.
You are meant
mm-hmm.
to like these people.
These people are absolutely in on what's going on. They're driving the bus here.
But there is another part of this which is more troubling to me, which is that this is a kind of voyeurism, a class voyeurism from your couch that you don't need to feel bad about. So all these stereotypes are being offered and confirmed in many cases, mm-hmm. but they're rich, so it's okay. So I can look at these working class people, even though they're not working class. I can look
right.
at these rednecks, these hillbillies, and I don't feel that sense of grossness that you do when you watch Honey Boo Boo, because you feel like these people are being exploited. You feel like you're looking at poverty there. There's a
desperation.
And desperation.
There's no desperation
like
in
the
show.
The fact that there's a camera crew in their house is their ticket out. Right.
Right.
That here, that's not the case. So it
no.
feels, it doesn't come with that sort of sick dread. Honey Boo Boo.
I
and
agree.
Then these people, I mean,
no sick dread, raves Glenn Weldon.
The other thing is, one thing, I mean, these people are well-spoken, if you pay attention. I mean, they...
Right. I think one of my favorite lines, I think it's from the premiere of season 4,
CEO Duck is looking at something and there's a beat. And he says, well, that went swimmingly. Uh-huh. And you're like, oh, you broke character.
Yeah. And you mentioned breaking character, because this was my initial frustration with the show. As I started out, I actually started with that episode as well, the first episode of season 4, mm-hmm. where Willie's generation of Robertsons ends up throwing a wedding for the eldest Robertsons, which, I mean, you talk about producers' contrivances.
Yeah, right.
My problem with the show in the beginning that wore away as it went on was that it felt actually a little more scripted and more contrived than most reality shows
I
watch.
I picked up on that.
And I watched, I watched some interviews with Willie Robertson, the CEO Duck, as Trey called him. And he was very, very charming and ingratiating and spoke as a delightful conversationalist in ways that he doesn't on the show because it feels like he's reading lines. Mm-hmm. For me, it was very tricky to get past. And some of the humor of the show I felt worked better than others.
I think we should have like lights hanging. We'll do those in those trees right over there.
Let's do the reception area over here.
Okay.
You want the definition of cruel and unusual punishment?
You want to have that river in the background
beautiful.
Right there.
And the sun will be setting back there.
Are y'all done with us? Are we finished?
No.
Are y'all gone?
Is hanging out on the riverbank while the fish are biting and I'm stuck setting up for a wedding that's 50 years late.
We just want to make sure we're on the same page before we tell you guys what to do. Because
do we need to stand here while you're trying to figure that out? Or
I mean, I wouldn't call this work. To me, this is more in line with torture.
There's an awful lot of kind of chicks is crazy
yeah,
kind
right.
of vibe to it of like, oh, when your wife's a witch, witch kind of stuff that,
right.
that I didn't find as interesting. And where the show won me over entirely was, near the end, again, they're getting together and there's a prayer around the table, but you get a sense that this is a rare television family that completely unreservedly loves each other.
Right.
Yes. And fundamentally treats each other well. It's a very functional family.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways that I understood as I was, because this is not, it's not a show that I had caught up with. I understood why so many people react to it.
Yeah. I have to say, I started not with the season 4 premiere. I came to that at the end of my watching. I started with the very first episode. And they really kind of spell it out right at the beginning. They spell out this show is about a family that sticks together,
mm-hmm.
a family that has dinner together, a family that is always there at the end of the day. And Papa, whatever his name, the patriarch,
Phil,
he has this whole long speech about how he's going to teach his grandkids to live off the land. They're going to know how to catch a fish and take the head off a frog and
make
peel
that
it.
Jelly.
And
well, there is a general puncturing of stereotypes going on. These are extremely smart and shrewd people.
Yeah. In that same first episode, there's a moment where one of the brothers, I think it's Jace, spells out what we would call work-life balance. He says, speaking of Willie the CEO, if you're too busy to go hunting or fishing, you're too busy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, as a gay dude in a major metropolitan city on the East Coast, I'm not in a circle of friends who are like, did you see Duck Dynasty? I'm not in that circle.
Right.
The way they kind of, Breaking Bad.
Right.
But there is huge swaths of the public who have been onto this show long before me.
Mm-hmm.
And
this is the NASCAR of reality television.
I guess. I mean, because they have helped me discover the reality show that doesn't make me feel gross.
That's a big achievement. Now, I do worry about this show because this show is so gigantically successful. You are about to see a Robertson family Christmas album.
Ooh. No, you're not.
Yes, you are. It's called Duck the Halls.
Oh, for
comes out
Duck
of
Duck
yeah,
the Halls.
Yeah. yeah.
Well, one of the wives is a singer.
So I do worry, of course, about it being bastardized and made less fun for everyone involved. But as it stands right now, I was taken aback by the sweetness of it. By the way, sports trivia fact, Phil mm-hmm. Robertson, the family patriarch, was ahead of Terry Bradshaw, NFL Hall of Famer, on the depth chart at Louisiana Tech University, quit football, was offered a pro football contract, gave it up because he wanted to spend more time hunting and fishing.
Awesome.
Duck hunting, duck season.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Duck hunting and football did not go hand in hand for him.
Okay, I got to say, I am totally Team Godwin.
Yes, Team Godwin.
In the season 4 premiere with all the guys running around.
He works at the shop.
He's not one of the family. He's just like a sidekick. So in the season 4 premiere with all the Robertson guys running around griping about weddings and women and what all, he's like,
I like women.
Why?
Chicken dance.
And then he does the chicken dance. Godwin's function on the show is he's the out of left field guy.
Right.
And I am totally down with him.
Right. It's a very likable show.
I was charmed by it completely.
I would say ingratiating.
I guess what I would say about it is not a tense show.
No.
The thing is, I watched that and then I had an episode of Ray Donovan to watch. And when you compare and contrast, I think I'll go back and watch more Duck Dynasty.
It is a very comfort foodie show.
Exactly.
And that's big. Well, that brings us to our final segment. As always, we are going to go around the table with what is making us happy this week. Let's start with Trey Graham.
Big Fish are making me happy. Big Fish, the new musical based on Tim Burton's film novel.
Well, talk about a reboot.
Yeah, right. And the not just the film, but the novel that spawned it. See what I did there? Previews on Broadway a few days ago. It is actually one of the most anticipated shows of the Broadway season. Obviously, an inherently theatrical story, as it is a story about a man who likes to tell stories. And a cast, including Bobby Steggert, Kate Baldwin, and Norbert Leo Butts, that is kind of a dream team. And I just got my opening night invitation in the email today. So that's what is making me happy to start with. Number two.
Do you need a guest?
Number two, also in the email today, news from Variety that Ellen Page has been tapped to lead a thing that I suspect is making Glenn Weldon happy, and that is the movie adaptation of Queen and Country.
Greg Rucka's really good, really fantastic spy series. It's about a female British spy. It's not glamorous. It's not James Bond. It's very gritty. It's very real, and it's fantastic. So I'm looking forward to that.
It's actually one of the books that when I asked years ago, what makes an excellent graphic novel or comic book, it's one of the books that Glenn Weldon put together in a little care package and gave to me.
That's right.
Didn't actually read it, of course, because I'm that guy.
Also, of course.
Well, thank you, Trey Graham. Glenn Weldon, what do you got?
All right, by the time this episode airs, this thing that I'm about to play you will have been all over the place and you'll be tired of it. It's over.
I think I know what this is.
But, however, it came out on Friday.
Yeah.
And I love it. Dog goes woof, cat goes meow. Bird goes tweet and mouse goes squeak. Cow goes moo, frog goes crow. And the elephant goes toot.
The elephant goes toot.
The elephant does go toot. And the seal goes ow, ow, ow. But there's one sound that no one knows. What does the fox say? Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh. All right. So this is Ylvis.
With a Y.
With a Y. Ylvis. They are a Norwegian comedy music duo. They are the Norwegian Flight of the Conchords. They are the Norwegian Lonely Planet. They're not like Weird Al Yankovic. They don't parody a specific song. Right. They're parodying a style. Yeah. And the thing you have to do when you do that is make sure that it sounds exactly like the parody.
Exactly.
It sounds exactly like the style you're doing. Now, to these old curmudgeonly ears, this song sounds exactly like the things that our tweens are pouring into their ears every day. It is on topic. It is right. It is spot on that sweet spot. And the video is very funny, and I like it. I would recommend, actually, one of their earlier songs, Stonehenge, also very funny.
Okay. Thank you, Glenn. Tony Ballard Brown, what do you got?
Okay. I've been happy about this thing for a week or so. It hasn't happened yet. But I'm just so happy.
Is it What Does the Fox Say?
No.
Is it Idris Elba in the long-form dramatic reboot of What Does the Fox Say?
No.
Okay.
All right, what is it?
It is Idris Elba, however. You don't, Idris.
We just make a point of
I'm
not mentioning
everything
him when you're
I
not
can,
on the show.
Honey, to get you in my clutches. So, Luther just aired in the U.S. and it ended. It was everything I wanted it to be and more. Now they're talking about doing a movie that would be a prequel to the series, and that to me is happiness, because I want to know why John Luther was so intense. Because when we are introduced to him, he is returning to the force, and he and his wife are separate. Like, there's a story that has happened that we aren't privy to that possibly could explain the intenseness of John Luther, DCI John Luther. And I hope this is true. I mean, I've seen it all over the place, so I hope that's true, because I really am interested to see. So, and also, if they could, in this prequel, give me more insight into John Luther's character, if they could tell me more about what made Alice as sort of cuckoo as she is.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you, Tanya Ballard Brown. I got two things quickly. One is I finally, over the weekend, embarrassingly long delayed, finally started watching Freaks and Geeks.
Oh, sure.
A show that had eluded me. Not eluded. I mean, I knew about it. I bought it on DVD probably a dozen years ago and never sat down and watched it. And of course, though I plunked down probably $40 for the DVDs however long ago, I watched it on Netflix.
Right.
It is wonderful, as everyone besides me already knows.
Yep.
I love that the very first scene pans below the bleachers, and the first thing you see are three gigantic movie stars in the form Jason Segel, right. Seth Rogen, and James Franco.
In this unsuccessful TV show.
In this horribly unsuccessful show brought to you by Judd Apatow and Paul Feig. It's just everybody associated with it.
Who are clearly going to go on to do nothing.
Yeah. Yes. It's just lovely, and I found, like most shows, it starts a little slow as they're establishing who all the characters are. Though, I will say, one of the best opening credit sequences ever, just in that they're bringing in each character and posing them for a photo, and you capture who each person is in literally a second, which is so smart.
Don't you want to just go back to the mid-90s or whenever this show was on and take the executives from the network and the American public, on the other hand, and just bang their heads together?
Like two coconuts.
Knock, knock. What are you thinking?
In a way, though, I mean, we've talked about shows like this before where, you know, there are certain shows like this. They're seeds. They're seedlings.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
They're not meant to stick around for a while. They're like Mr. Show is like this, or Arrested Development is like this, or Upright Citizens Brigade, where, like, everybody associated with it is going to be gigantically successful, just not at this.
Exactly.
Anyway, Freaks and Geeks, it really is wonderful. I'm just trying to portion it out to myself.
Chocolate good, says Thompson.
Yeah, exactly. Not a groundbreaking pick. So my other thing is a little bit less known. A new album, which actually we have streaming on the NPR Music website, but that's not why I'm picking it. I'm picking it because it's fantastic. It is by a group called San Fermin. It is the brainchild of a guy named Ellis Ludwig Leone, who plays piano in the band, but is otherwise like the farthest thing from a frontman. But he has three singers doing his bidding, and together they create this incredible chamber pop, little kind of mini orchestral pieces with different voices playing different parts. And the one guy has kind of like a Matt Berninger, Bill Callahan, like deep flat baritone. And then the other singers are the two women from Lucius, which is a very, very fun group. They don't sing harmonies. They sing in unison.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just in love with this record. It's very ambitious. It's like 17 tracks in 55 minutes, which, by today's standards is quite long.
Right.
And I just was completely engrossed by it. Let's actually hear a little bit of the song The Renaissance.
It's easier far away. Imagine this another way. I know that to every play the best ones cry. Please come wake me up.
San Fermin, self-titled album, comes out September 17th. It's really, really wonderful. It's streaming on the site now. By all means, check it out.
Absolutely.
Great.
All right, and that brings us to the end of this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at I Dislike Steven. That's STEPHEN. You can follow Trey Graham at Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow Glenn Weldon at G-H Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. There is no H in it. You can follow Tanya Ballard Brown at T-double-B. That's T-D-O-U-B-L-E-B. You can follow our absent host, Linda Holmes, at NPR Monkey C. You can follow our producer, Lauren Migaki, at L Migaki, M-I-G-A-K-I. And you can follow our esteemed producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Boy, that's a lot of spelling. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music, to which you are no doubt tapping your feet right now. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.